House Committee on Audit and Human Service Budget Reform to order. Today is Thursday, May 8th. We are continuing with our informational format. And I see we have on the agenda Barney Spate. And I will, for the record,
you grew hair and got better looking.
Indicate that Barney has never looked better.
That's real Kentucky windage.
Yeah, that is real Kentucky windage. What we're actually going to do today, and I encourage all the questions from the committee to the committee or the committee to Holly. Holly's going to run through the latest iteration of where the bill is, draft changes, which we do not have copies of. Were those finished?
The S3s, you got a phone call at 2:30 this afternoon. So you ought to get them.
Yeah. Let's recess the committee for just a moment. Yeah. We will recess for just a very few minutes.
Here, you want to copy of mine?
Need to have Holly Robinson from LC with us to go through the latest iteration. And Holly, you might want to spend some time if members go back. This is, in word order, this is almost a total rewrite. But in context and content, it's finesses and tweaks. I think that's a fair characterization.
And in some cases, slices and dices.
Yeah, but
and spits out.
And I say that in particular about sections 1 and 2, where we did a lot of changes up front. Anyway, without further ado, also committee, we have a recap summary sheet of each of the sections. And we'll get copies for everyone in attendance as soon as they're ready. We apologize for that inconvenience.
Go ahead. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson, Legislative Counsel. You should have two documents in front of you, the -3 amendments dated 5803, which I believe is today, and a summary of the current amendments that was prepared jointly by Rick and myself. And I would encourage you, I think, to work off of these two documents together.
Holly, could you get more friendly with at least one of those microphones?
Yeah, I could get more friendly with one of these microphones. I want a little lapel, you know.
That would be cool.
I want to be Oprah Winfrey.
We all
do. That would be tough.
Actually, you know, I really want to be is Nina Turtenberg. I mean, in my next life, I'm going to be Nina Turtenberg.
Sure.
Are you ready for me?
Yeah. Any time today would be fine.
Who's Nina Turtenberg?
Nina Turtenberg, NPR. She does their legal affairs of correspondence.
Oh, okay. I suppose you have to watch TV for that, right?
No, listen to the radio.
Radio.
Driving.
I don't
know. And you have to know what NPR is.
Right. Yeah.
I've listened.
He said that, not me.
I've listened before. I try not
to
make a habit
TV
of it, but I have.
Yeah.
All right, committee, let's try to focus here.
Witness. Let me attempt to get us refocus. S3 amendments that you have in front of you, first of all, are a total replacement of the original printed bill. Section 1 of the bill adds much of the new bill to a series in Oregon law, which is 414705 to 714750. The reason that's primarily significant and that I highlight it is only that those are the statutes that were enacted beginning in 1989 and 91, Senate Bill 27 that initiated the health plan. And so this is really intended to be very specifically changes and modifications, additions to the original health plan structure as enacted in Oregon law. Section 2 is the new definition section for the bill. There are 3 or 4 definitions which I will walk you through. The first one is as my copy editor said, this is a little odd, but it's a definition called the able to serve additional enrollees. And this is an attempt in the bill to address those situations where there is some sort of managed care organization, and in this case they are able to assign an enrollee to a person or entity that's primarily responsible for coordinating services. The intent of this language is to get at capacity. If there is capacity, if you can assign somebody to either a person or entity that is primarily responsible for coordinating care, then you would have the ability to serve additional enrollees. For those of you that are less familiar with the health plan, the reason that we use the word person or entity is that in some situations you might be assigned, and I'll pick on Kaiser since Barney's not here, you might be assigned, if you were an enrollee of the health plan going through Kaiser, to a particular clinic, which would be an entity. You would not at that point be assigned to a specific physician. And so in this case, you are assigned to an entity, an organization, a clinic, that would be able to serve you. Designated area is the second definition. It refers to a geographic area of the state defined by the department by rule that is served by a prepaid managed care health services organization. That gives the ability of the department to establish different areas of the state than they're currently using, or maybe the same, but it allows them to identify areas in which they are concerned about service, and as we go through this, you'll see why that becomes more important. Physician care organization is a new definition, and it's an organization that contracts with the department on a prepaid capitated basis to provide specific health services. And those specific health services, if you want to turn to page 6 of the bill, because the definition of 414705 changes, is that a physician care organization would contract to provide provider services and supplies, prescription drugs, and health promotion and disease prevention services. They may also, in the second sentence reads, contract to provide outpatient services. There will be more discussion later on in the bill about the ability of physician care organizations to provide most of the services under the health plan, with the exception of hospital services, so that they don't have risk for those services. Prepaid managed care health services organization is a new definition in here, though it exists in Oregon law, and it identifies all of the managed health, dental, mental health, or chemical dependency organizations that contract with the department on a prepaid capitated basis. Under 414725, which is that part of Oregon law that allows these contracts to be created, a prepaid managed health care organization may be a dental care organization, fully capitated health plan, physician care organization, mental health organization, or a chemical dependency organization. It is any entity that has a contract on a capitated basis and covers all of the various types of organizations. So at this point, those are new definitions that will, as you will see, be woven into the fabric of this new legislation. Questions?
I think we should just point out the importance of adding those in our myopic focus on the physical health side. We are leaving out some benefits that had not been included in the categorical population, i.e. Dentistry, and also if we're able to expand populations for additional mental health services. So that's the reason we put those in.
Other questions before I go on? Am I doing okay? Section 3 of the bill is new and sets in a policy that says a person who is eligible for or receiving physical health, dental, mental health, or chemical dependency services must be enrolled in a prepaid managed health care services organization to receive health services for which the person is eligible. This concept was originally addressed in the original draft, and there was a lot of confusion about the types of services one would be receiving from a managed care organization or a prepaid managed care services organization. What this does, in part, is to make very clear that we have created basically or identified four categories of services. We now have physical health, mental health, dental, and chemical dependency services. We use these terms over and over again, but it makes it very clear that these are all organizations or entities that would be providing these organizations. Now, subsection 1 of Section 3 is the rule, and then subsection 2 and subsection 3 are the exceptions to this rule. And the first set of exceptions to this rule is in subsection 2 and identifies all of those persons to whom this mandatory enrollment requirement does not apply. And that list includes individuals who are non-citizens and eligible only for labor and delivery and emergency treatment services, persons who are American Indians and are a member of a federally recognized tribe. And then the third category is a category that gives is a person who, in this bill indirectly, gives the department authority by rule to exempt from additional persons from the mandatory enrollment requirements of this section, including the list of A through E, which so far include persons who are also eligible for Medicare, a woman in her third trimester of pregnancy, a person under 19 years of age who is placed out of state, a person under 19 who is medically fragile and has special health care needs, and a person with major medical coverage. Again, these are individuals who the department has authority by rule to exempt from the mandatory enrollment requirement if it doesn't make sense for those individuals.
And just to point out for the committee, and I know you all get this, I mean, that's a major change, is that we put a fairly comprehensive exemption process in here, automatic exemption, from the major thrust of the bill, which is you must be enrolled in managed care if you live in an area that is geographically covered by managed care. So I think this is a significant addition and improvement to the bill.
Question?
Representative Mona Sanders.
Thank you. What was the reasoning for eliminating prenatal, a woman in her third trimester of pregnancy, prenatal care for that?
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, we're not eliminating them. They will continue to get services from fee-for-service providers. It just doesn't, it didn't make sense from a policy perspective to require that they change providers at that point.
Thank you.
And also,
the issue is,
changing
go ahead, Representative.
Also, on a capitated basis, picking up a patient in a third trimester pregnancy is extremely expensive potentially. You've not had the capitation for the previous 9 months for that patient. So it comes in at a very time which can really hurt an organization. We have an organization now being hurt very badly by the fact they elected not to eliminate people coming into the plan just as if, and what usually happens is they come into the plan while they're delivering the baby.
Yeah.
They show up at the hospital, get enrolled in a capitated plan, they've taken on all the risk and know the payment for it.
Yeah.
And they have not been, that plan hasn't been paid for nor been allowed to manage that individual prenatal care, et cetera, for the duration of the pregnancy. They walk in, you know, they have, you know, a bad outcome. That risk should be on the state. But they get the care. It's just the plan is not at risk for it.
However, Ms. Chair, by making it permissible, it would allow the plan to pick up that person so that the infant is getting immediate care upon birth. So,
all right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. Well, that's my question. Is there then a mechanism through which the person delivers their child and then we try to transition them into a managed care plan after the delivery?
Yes.
Well, and in many cases, Representative Merkley, while after delivery the mother may not be eligible, the child will.
Child is instantaneous.
More questions on that one?
Yes. Holly, we've got a person under 19 years of age who is medically fragile and has special health care needs. How about someone over 19?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, this was intended to address the concern that was raised about the children who are currently being served in the medically fragile unit of the Department of Human Services. The issue of others who are basically being served under other categorically eligible populations, we really did not discuss, in part because their current status, I don't think, was not. Part of it is this is a population that's currently, as we understand it, being served in the fee-for-service payment system, where the current group of people with disabilities are, was not brought to us as one that has to change. They also have enough discretion in here that if it's a problem, it can be, the department can exempt out, in some ways, whoever they want.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
But this was specifically, actually, I mean, this specific provision was specifically addressed to address a problem that was brought to this committee at least twice, which was the kids in the medically fragile unit. And so we wanted to be very clear about that group. We didn't really discuss the other policy, the other groups that in that universe.
I think Medicare becomes involved in it after age 19 also, and for some, these people are well taken care of, but they're not necessarily the people who would be under normally under a capitated system. It should be a fee-for-service Medicare amalgam to take care of this. That's the way they're normally taken care of. Is Tina
Also, a lot of them, Mr. Chair, Representative Marks, there are a lot of them are currently being served in the capitated system, and there's no reason to change them under the policy.
Thank you.
Thank you. I feel so official. Subsection 3 of Section 3.
Well, you look pretty official, too.
You're doing great, Barney. Keep it up.
But I don't have a tie on. I understand that's a requirement of this committee.
Not for Barney, actually.
Subsection 3 tries to address another part of the exemption from the mandatory enrollment process, but it's an exemption from the other direction. And what this exemption says, and it covers all of the entities, is that if a prepaid managed care organization that provides either physical health or dental services or mental health services or chemical dependency services in a particular area cannot expand to include additional individuals, then the person's entitled to services through the fee-for-payment system. So it's the first door of any of those organizations is can this person be served by the organization that is serving those individuals in the designated area. If, in fact, they do not have the capacity or are not able to serve additional people, then any of those additional services would be provided through the fee-for-service payment system. But it, because in part of the confusion earlier on, this makes it clear that for all of those doors, when we diagram this, it's the physical health organizations, the dental, the mental health, and the chemical dependency organizations, each as separate entities.
Question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. How is that determination made? Is that given to a particular group to say, yes, we agree that we've made the determination that they're not able to serve additional individuals, or is it at the call of the organization itself, and is that changed day to day, so on and so forth? How do we make this work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, as I understand it, it's part of the contract process through the department. Right now, they currently have contracts that serve, I'll make up a number, 100 people. If there are additional individuals that the department knows need to be served in that area, they will say, can you serve an additional 10? They'll either will or won't. If they do, the contract gets amended. If not, this provision kicks in.
Thank you.
And right now, as it currently exists, we're trying to refine this number, but it appears including the standard population, which is currently served, in addition to that 419,000, 420,000 people we're currently serving, the plans have represented to us that between all of them as an aggregate, they can serve an additional 100,000 plus individuals. It's a very significant number.
Chair, I'm reading over this for the first time.
Some sections haven't changed, Representative Freeze.
Okay. We had a permissive category originally in this list for bad actors, and it's not here anymore. Remember, for those people who, for some reason,
were difficult.
Representative Bates, you know what I'm talking about,
right? It's a difficult
In line 16 through 18, it says, including but not limited to. That's what we took care of.
Okay, but I thought
we did have one there before, okay. and we thought we just.
Well, this is. I mean, you know what I'm getting. There's that aspect of it, but Holly basically said that the way we've got this written now, they can exempt anybody they want.
To some degree,
and I mean, there was clearly we needed to have language for them to do things that show up, but I also thought that we kind of wanted to have the known universe as much listed as possible.
My memory was it couldn't quite come up with language for that.
Okay.
Okay. And it was
really
bad actor.
Yeah, we couldn't a personality disorder. It couldn't quite get there. We struggled for hours and left it this way.
So Section 3, then, in summary, is sort of the kernel of there will be mandatory enrollment in some type of prepaid managed care organization if it exists and able is to serve clients. There are individuals who may be exempted out, and there may be circumstances under which organizations, because due to lack of capacity, will not be expanded, and the fee-for-service system will be the secondary system. Section 4 Then talks about directs the department to use prepaid managed care plans to the greatest extent possible. We did add language in here, and you'll see it on pages 15 and 16 to again emphasize that we're talking about physical health, dental, mental health, and chemical dependency, and any of those types of services. One of the points I would like to make at this point is that you will see in a lot of this that references to either 1989 or 1991 session laws are being eliminated. These are actions that are being taken by our office because we like to beautify the ORSs, and these are obsolete references that were, for example, some of them were waiver requirements, so when the first waiver got into place, something got triggered. None of them are intended, and I want the record to reflect this, any substantive change in what the underlying provisions require. They just are basically deleting obsolete language that no longer is necessary in the statutes. For example, on lines 7 and 8, where it says funded pursuant to Section 9, Chapter 836, Oregon Laws 1989, that was the section that said the very first time that the Legislative Assembly or the A-Board would fund services to the line. Obviously, that's obsolete at this point, and now there's services being provided by the Legislative, funded by the Legislative Assembly. So, again, it's not an intent of those deletions. It's not to change the policy. It's to remove unnecessary verbiage so that we can add more verbiage. The only other change in Section 4 that is significant is it just clarifies, it's not really significant, that, in fact, the department can use a fee-for-service payment system, again, and I'm on 29 and 30, line 29 and 30 on page 3, for the same physical health, dental, mental health, or chemical dependency services provided under the health plan. In those areas where a prepaid managed care organization is not able to serve additional enrollees. That's Section 4. Section 5 grants to the department the authority to contract with a physician care organization under certain circumstances. And Section 5 has been significantly rewritten since anybody has seen this, so I'll walk you through it very slowly. If the Department of Human Services has not been able to contract with a fully capitated health plan or plans in a designated area able to serve additional enrollees, and again, that's meaning that they can expand, the department may contract with a physician care organization in the designated area. The Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research shall develop criteria that the
department... Holly, let's stop for a minute. I'm a little concerned with in the designated area because we had talked about an FCHIP being able to go into a new area and develop a PCO. Does that limit that ability by tying them to the area on the front end?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, it does not, so long as there's an FCHIP in there that can't expand.
Okay, but it says may contract with a PCO in the designated area.
Right.
I'm wondering if that precludes somebody from coming into the area.
No, there are two different thoughts. If you have an FCHIP that, or one or more that can't grow, they can contract with any PCO. So they're not. It's not the same entity. So I don't think that it would preclude. I don't think it would preclude what you're saying. Now again, these words are freshly off the computer, so if they're not working. But I don't believe that that would be a problem. The Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research shall develop criteria that the department must use to determine the circumstances under which the department may contract with the physician care organization. And these, the criteria developed by the office shall include but not be limited to the following. The physician care organization must be able to assign an enrollee to a person or entity that's primarily responsible for coordinating services that addresses capacity. The contract with the physician care organization does not threaten the financial viability of other fully capitated plans in the area, if there are any. The contract with the physician care organization must be consistent with the legislative intent of using prepaid managed health care organizations to provide services. And four, whether the fully capitated plan may convert to a physician care organization to provide services under 705 to 750. These words and concepts were... particularly subsection B, were words that Bruce Goldberg and I talked about late this morning So I recognize that they may not be perfect, but in this case, they're setting the criteria, and then the department basically, the theory, the policy decisions, words aside at the moment, is the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research will establish the criteria that the department may follow, and then the department may choose whether or not it wants to contract with the PCO. So those are the big policy issues.
We'll talk.
Yeah. It's first words out. Let's start.
The policy we're trying to achieve here is, one, maintain the financial integrity and viability of the existing FCHIPs, but yet open a door, particularly in areas that are unserved in any capacity by physical managed care, to allow the establishment of a PCO in that designated area. PCO, being still managed care, provides almost all the services with the exception of the hospital. They're not at risk for the hospital piece. Now, it gets a little murkier when you have PCOs, a PCO or PCOs in a given geographic area that cannot expand, and yet there's still a significant amount of fee-for-service clients in that area. We don't want to do anything to harm the existing PCOs, but we still want to get as many people as possible into as much managed care, translate, PCO, as much as possible.
You mean that
Or the fee-for-service
yes.
into some form of managed care, in this case, PCO. That's the public policy we're trying to achieve.
Considering I rewrote this after 6 o'clock last night.
Assuming these words say that, we're happy with it, but we have questions. Please continue.
Policy decisions, however, are clearer. So that's Section 5, which is a work in progress. Section 6 directs the department to contract primarily with Kaiser to provide services that would otherwise be offered by a physician care organization, and those are those services that are defined in 414-705-1, 2, 4, and 5, which again are provider services, outpatient services, prescription drugs, and health and wellness. Section 7 is new to this iteration of the bill, and this is where in the original Senate Bill 27, there was an attempt to define what type of services would be approved and funded by the Legislative Assembly and provided to recipients of the Oregon Health Plan. The current language was provider services and supplies, outpatient services, inpatient hospital services, and health promotion and disease prevention. What this amendment does is basically clarify prescription drugs as being one of those services. Clearly, it's been provided. It just further defines them.
Okay, Holly?
Yeah.
Page 6, line 6, was that in 2 or was that added in 3?
Say that again.
Page 6.
Right.
Line 6.
Right.
That was not in dash 2, was it? We had a conversation last night about whether drugs were covered under services and supplies.
It is new to this. Let me think. It is probably new to the dash twos, but it came out as a result in part of trying to identify.
Well, this is the big stakes question here.
Yeah.
Well, the services have always been provided.
I know.
No.
But whether prescription drugs were in the twos is a big stakes question here. So.
No, I think they were actually.
Oh, damn. Okay. I lost a milkshake on that, so.
What is that all about? Hey, inquiring minds want to know.
Well, I mean, we had talked about that at the last.
Blackberry?
We didn't. Ooh, I could give him a liver milkshake because he didn't specify what kind. Well, I mean, the whole discussion about what was the assumption of inclusion in the language that had been there for a long time and the need to get more specificity.
And
this was actually tied, if I might, Mr. Chair, to the whole conversation about trying to identify and call out, for lack of a better word, what a PCO was going to provide and not provide.
Right.
And rather than using a different definition, which is where we started in this conversation, and trying to define medical services, I had an idea that maybe we should use current law, and it led in part to this.
It cost me a milkshake.
I'm sorry.
Yes. That's okay.
Section 8 is...
we'll get Larry under control.
There's Section 8 addresses two issues. It adds a requirement that the Health Services Commission consider clinical effectiveness and cost effectiveness of health services in determining their relevant importance, and it also removes the language regarding the commission's retention of a actuary for the purposes of determining capitation
for
per capita rates.
Sub 1 in Section 8, I'm looking at the list.
Where are you?
Page 6, lines 9 through 16. The commission will, it's about the commission holding the hearings and who they will solicit testimony from. And I notice a glaring omission of the public. And I'm wondering, you know, clearly as we've evolved in healthcare, things that we do in Medicaid affect what happens in private sector and stuff like that. And I'm just wondering if we ought to have the commission solicit from the public also rather than just from the constituent base and the providers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
I'm late.
Representative Bates. I'm just so flush with victory thinking of this milkshake.
Yeah. In fact, the commission does that, and in lines 17, 18, 19, it's directed to take public testimony and does take public testimony. In fact, they do more public testimony than anything else.
But his point is, shouldn't a member of the commission...
No. It says in sub 1, the commission shall solicit testimony and information from advocates representing, and then it has all those folks. And I've been to some of those commission meetings, and you're not going to get general public there unless you ask them to show up for the large part. I understand what it says below, okay. Representative Bates, but what I'm saying is we should make a effort to make sure folks from the business community and these other folks who are impacted directly or indirectly by the decisions we make are represented and have their opinions heard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I would be happy to work with you on making further amendments to that section.
Well, we hadn't amended that.
Which we haven't even talked about yet.
Okay.
I hear you.
Okay.
Section 9, then, says two things primarily from a policy perspective. It gives the Health Services Commission the authority to retain an actuary to develop benchmarks for capitation rates and fee-for-service payment rates, and then establishes a process for setting those rates.
Yeah.
Without going into the details, I mean, the big picture in this is their authority to hire an actuary who is going to set the benchmarks and then the process for setting these rates and developing a comparison between the department's budget and these benchmarks. So that's section 9.
Did we do all of 8?
We do all of 8.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't go all of 8. All of 8 or all of 9?
No, all of 8 in terms of we went off on who was going to be, you know, involved in the healthcare commission process.
The only other change, significant change, new change is the language on page 7, lines 12 through 14.
Right.
In terms of changes in here.
Otherwise,
it's pretty much the way it was in the dash.
Okay.
Then section 9, I said, is the benchmark, setting rates by benchmark, setting benchmark rates and the process for doing that. I'm not sure at this point it's a good use of time to go through the specifics, given the fact that they are evolving, but the policy contained in Section 9 is allowing the commission to retain an actuary to determine benchmark, set of benchmarks for the capitated rates and fee-for-service rates.
And
set a process for setting those rates and then comparing the benchmark versus the actual rates the department has. That's the big picture. I don't want to go into the little picture.
The whole concept here is allow OMAP to continue to do what they're doing, But in addition to that, in terms of establishing rates, but we also want the Health Services Commission to employ an actuary to help determine cost. Then totally separate from both of those is the appropriation, you know, in the basic categories, hospital, inpatient, and outpatient, physician, and pharmaceutical, and then have an additional column, if you will, on the same page that shows the gap between cost and what we've appropriated. It's to show, really, in simplest words, you know, how Oregon is underfunding health care in this state.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, it's more than that. I mean, we're trying to set up a process that's more transparent than what we've currently got so that it's understandable, so that people can look at it and realize what's there. And also it's an attempt to try to come up with a system that will allow us to set reimbursement rates that are fair on the front end, so that the providers know going in that they're going to be treated equally, and they'll either share the growth or share the pain equally. And part of that is an attempt to make them more cooperative with each other, so that, because there'll be nothing to gain from one side or the other, because they're all going to be in the same ball game.
I'm not sure we're going to be able to pull that last one off.
That's our goal.
But that's our goal. Please continue.
Moving on.
Drunk. Section 10 and Section 10A create a temporary provision where the department is directed to contract with fully capitated health plans to provide administrative services for eligible persons who receive certain health services on a non-capitated or a fee-for-service payment system basis, and those services would be prescription drug management, inpatient and outpatient hospital services, utilization of non-emergency medical transportation in designated areas where there are not transportation brokerages, and durable medical equipment and supplies. And then it describes the process whereby those contracts would be developed. This, I don't think, has been the change to this from the dash 2's describe these services. Rather than managing these services, the plans are going to be providing administrative services in these specific areas. But it also is a temporary provision, and to let the department work on this concept and see how it goes. Sections 11 and 12.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Representative Bates.
It's just something that occurred to me. I thought we, in awarding the contracts to manage these services,
administer these services,
were we telling the concept we dealt with is that that contract had to show cost savings. We wouldn't want to be forcing the department to contract with someone who actually was going to do it at a higher expense than the agency would. We're kind of making an assumption that would happen, obviously. Does the capacity and competence take care of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, probably not as directly as you would want it.
Do we want competence, capacity, and something about economics in there?
We certainly could.
So, but we're still expecting feedback here, right? Okay, we're still expecting some department feedback on this section on the language. Okay.
Section is evolving as we speak, sections 11 and 12, I will describe generally and in one sentence, and these address most directly hospital reimbursement rates, and these are also under continuing discussion. I don't think there are any changes to either of those.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Markley.
Can we turn to Section 10 for just a moment? Is non-capitated synonymous with fee-for-service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Markley, good question, and yes. And at some point, I'm going to have to decide which term I'm going to use.
Okay.
So
thank you.
Because of some of the way I attempted to explain this the first time, it made more sense to use go to non-capitated basis, but in fact it is the same thing.
Okay, thank you.
And when I have a little more time, I'll get rid of the... We'll stick with one term.
Okay.
Section 13 has not changed for the purposes of this draft, or actually for the rest of the bill. 13 deals with the concept of the state hiring a pharmacy benefit manager to manage prescription drugs. Section 14 directs the department to work with fully capitated health plans to develop that proposal. I would also add, and this has stayed consistent, that the usage of the state's pharmacy benefit manager is optional for fully capitated health plans if they want to participate. And finally, Section 15 addresses the department's direction or direction to them to obtain supplemental rebates and participate in multi-state purchasing tools to obtain those. And then 16, 17, and 18 also have not changed. 16 addresses waiver approval for a large health plan change. 17 deals with residency and financial eligibility. And 18 through 20 address the operational and effective dates. This is new, I think, in this draft. The majority of the bill would become operative on October 1st, 2003. So for those pieces that directly impacted the Department of Human Services, they would have authority to take steps ahead of time to anticipate the implementation.
And there was a reason we went to that date, so.
Yes.
And the reason being that's the start of the federal fiscal year, and we're anticipating implementation on that date, and it's easier to delay implementation than to speed up implementation, and we didn't want to set a date and then have everything in place and not be able to do it, so.
Are you talking about July 1st?
No, we're talking about the October 1st.
Okay.
Any questions? You've done a wonderful job, as always.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we will be having more conversations, I do believe. So we'll wait till Mo gets back here.
Curly too,
yeah.
What's the question?
Well, do you have any questions for Holly? She wrapped it up, and we moved the bill. So,
great. I'd like to point out for those in attendance that the three guys primarily responsible for writing this bill and knows what's in it are
four.
The only
four.
Three guys. Hold on, behind the dais. So the real reason we're doing this.
Is so Rick can catch up.
Because we know you all get it just like that.
We worry about Ricky.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Oh, that's the cleanest I've seen it, and this is a lot of work. Looks pretty good.
Thank you.
I think we're just about there. Unless I missed something obvious, we've got a few little tweaks, and we're there.
I would say we're just about there, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, I would point out the major difference between the dash twos and this draft is we didn't have Representative Cruz saying continuously, film at 11, major rewrite, under consideration 14 times during the presentation. That's how close we are. So we're pretty close.
That's true. Okay, I hadn't thought about that. Okay,
I wasn't going to remind you until after it was over. Any other questions for Holly?
I would point out that while the three of us have been in, and Rick and Holly have been involved in extensively in this, there have been a lot of other folks, including representatives from the Senate President's office, the Republican Caucus office. I mean, it's been an inclusive process. So this isn't a total surprise to hardly anybody that's wanted to pay attention to it.
Including hospital association, the care plans, OMA, advocates. I think everyone's been involved in this. Are there?
Yeah, these have been long days. Thank you, Holly.
Mr. Chair, my pleasure.
Including Mr. Bishop, who sit with us today. We tried to get Ellen there, but she insists on going to these Ozzy concerts. Yeah. Any other business coming for us? Since the committee is leaving me, we'll adjourn.